In 3, 2, and 1. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the next day. Nope, we're going to do that again.
Amazing.
You do that
on purpose to kind of make it a level playing field. Just to kind of.
Hello everyone, welcome to the next stage. I'm Toby Vince and I will be your host for this episode. In this episode of the next stage, we are joined by Alex Hill, the writer and performer of the new solo piece, Hidden in the Edinburgh Fringe, Why I Stuck a Flare Up My Ass for England. Now, if the title hasn't given it away too much, it's definitely one of those pieces you're not going to want to miss. You know, it's got so much beautiful commentary on not just football, but masculinity, belonging. It's a great piece of new comedy. We got the chance to sit down and have a chat with Alex to get to learn all about the piece. Take a listen. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the next stage. Today, I am joined by Alex Hill from Roxy Dog Productions. Hi, Alex.
Hello. How's it going?
Very good. How are you today?
Yeah, I'm very well, thank you, Toby. Very happy to be here.
Very good, very good. Let's dive straight into this. So, you know, for everybody we've got on for our episodes this season, we're asking a bit more about how they relate to what Fringe is. So I'll pose a question to you. Fringe theatre mean to you?
Cool. Do you know what? I haven't, so I've been to a few kind of fringe theatres, if you like, around London. I saw sort of plays at the Finborough, the Hope Theatre, and places like that. But my first kind of fringe experience was last year. I decided that I'd just sort of go to the Fringe and check it out. I've heard so many great things about it. So to be honest with you, I think from that experience, I did 5 days. I did Monday to Friday. And it was kind of the most fulfilling, kind of eye-opening theatrical experience, if you like, that I've ever had, just purely because I've never had kind of the privilege of waking up at like 9 o'clock in the morning and then being hungover and then going to see a play at 9:30 with a coffee in my hand and then watching like an hour play for, you know, full of like amazing new stories and like new voices, and I think there's like this thing of kind of suspending your disbelief kind of even further than you have to do in these commercial theatres, because everything is kind of on the story and the characters when you know, you could be sat in any kind of venue. It's not your like traditional proscenium arch. It's more like you could be in like a hotel conference room watching a play about anything and everything, and that's just such kind of a unique intimate experience I don't think you can feel with kind of normal commercial theatre.
Oh, for sure. There's definitely, and I mean, space so far has been a really consistent thing that people have touched up upon when it comes to fringe theatre. And I think that's because fringe theatre, unlike, you know, in your word, in commercial theatre, it offers us as artists a bit more of a challenge. You've got to think about, okay, how do we adapt this work of mine to a completely bespoke space that more often than not isn't actually a theatre? It's not unknown for you to go to like the top room of a pub, for example. You know what I mean? Like it always offers a bit more of a challenge for us as artists. But I also think it offers a bit more of intimacy, I think, between like the performer and the audience. I think it gets a bit more of a stronger connection between the work that you're showing and the audience who are receiving it. You know what I mean?
No, absolutely. And that was something that kept kind of cropping up when I was at the Fringe last year, just the fact that you can kind of be sat, you know, a foot away from the performers. They're telling their story and they're kind of selling their soul, if you like, on the stage, and really kind of exposing every kind of part of who they are, because more often than not, These kind of fringe theatre performances are like such a collaboration, so they really do come straight from the artists. There's no kind of like middleman, it's just straight up there and working hard to kind of fulfill the story and fulfill the characters that they're portraying. And I think that's so exciting. I saw a tweet the other day that was, if anyone hears this, they're gonna like butcher me for copyright, but it was such an amazing tweet. It was like, all around London, there's actors giving like amazing performances above pubs, and that's such a beautiful kind of thing that we almost forget about, because a lot of the time, you know, they don't get the massive coverage that they deserve. So these big festivals at Edinburgh Fringe are so exciting to kind of really put those actors and performers in the spotlight.
Oh, for sure. So let's talk a bit more about this work that you're doing. So, you know, when Greta and I were doing research for the show, I honestly can't think of a show whose title has like captivated as much as this. I mean, you know, if you've clicked on the episode, you know this show is called Why I Stuck a Flare Up Me Arse for England. Now, you know, I'm going to let you talk about this. So, for any of our listeners who are unfamiliar with this subject, could you just give us a bit of a summary as to what the title of the show refers to and why you wanted to create a piece of theatre surrounding it?
Yeah, the title of the show is bananas, because obviously when you come out of drama school and people that are in your life that aren't sort of clued up on acting, like your nan, for example, is always asking when you're going to be in EastEnders or Coronation Street, or what's the next thing that you're doing. And, you know, I've been working like kind of muggle jobs, if you like. And then I was like, oh, actually, nan, I've written this kind of play. It's called Why I Stuck a Flare Up My Arse for England. And then she kind of just looks at me and doesn't really understand what's going on and if I'm kind of mentally sane. But I wanted the title to just be this kind of explosive thing that people kind of gravitate towards too, because it is based on a football fan. Now, there was one guy that got pictured doing this at the Euros 2020, which was in 2021, final before the game. But actually, the act of sticking a flare up your ass isn't kind of exclusive to that one guy. He was just the one that got kind of pictured doing it the most. But there were a few. It was kind of like a bit of a cult thing, I think. But yeah.
And no, I can't stress enough, like, if you're not listening to this, like, if you're not English or from the UK and have not like come across this, like, this was like a news thing, right? Like, yeah, this guy, there was this picture of a guy who literally just stuck like a lit firework up his bum, like circling around BBC News, ITV, whatever, like, and it was absolutely surreal. I just recall
it was bonkers, and it was also kind of like this wonderful act that people really were kind of split on opinion, and I became so kind of like transfixed by it almost, because I'm a football fan. I'm in this kind of weird middle of the Venn diagram where like a massive football fan but also a massive theatre fan. So like often I'll be at sort of Brentford, the team I support, at kind of 3 o'clock, and then watching, you know, Measure for Measure at 7:30. It's a really kind of strange social mix, but on the day of the final, I get really into sort of the England spirit, and I was due to watch the game kind of out of London, and everything just looked insane in London. So I said to my friend, why don't we head into London and see what the atmosphere is like, and then kind of head out and watch the final as we kind of planned to outside of London. So we headed to Wembley Way on the tube, and when we got there, we stood right at the top of Wembley Park tube station, and this is, we're talking like 1:30 in the afternoon, so there's still like 6-7 hours before kickoff, and the heat that was coming off these like hundreds of thousands of people, it was like something out of like Game of Thrones or something. It was bonkers. And I just remember just sort of being hit by this kind of this heat and this atmosphere, and it was really strange because it was so joyous and so like feel good, especially after the lockdown and kind of this big release for a lot of people. But just kind of ever so slowly, the atmosphere just started to get a little bit darker and just turn as people were getting more drunk and abusing drugs a bit more. And that was happening out in the open, which was kind of like crazy to me. And it was, I mean, the guy that did it describes it as there being no rules that day. And so I did a lot of research into that and those news articles that were written about him. And there's this amazing, I think it's a Guardian article that kind of says, should we be kind of looking at this guy and think, God, like, he's horrendous. Why would he do that? Or was he just having a bit of fun? And then, yeah, so I just kind of really became transfixed by this one act, and it kind of became the starting image, if you like, for the play. And then I just developed this character, this kind of die-hard football fan, and really questioned what it means to be a die-hard football fan. How do you become that? And how do you really express your love for the game? So that's kind of what the play is about. It's about tribalism and belonging and the want and the need for kind of specifically young men to fit in to today's society, all told through the lens of this kind of diehard football fan that does this one big act. And I describe it as like the snapping point of the play. It coincides with something else kind of really dramatic in Billy, the character Billy's life. And that act kind of goes, yeah, hand in hand with something else that is just a massive life event for the character. And it's, yeah, it's breaking point.
It's interesting to me how, like, we convey passion in this sense, you know? Because it's, I mean, you know, football, it's the national sport of England, right? And for a lot of people, it's, you know, it's like a very core, it's an energy right inside you. You know, it's it's not so, like, being able to watch a game isn't about, you know, 90 minutes to 2 hours of people kicking around the ball. It's a lot more, you know. There's so much, like, involvement that goes into it that it's, that again, as you say, it goes beyond, like, what the sport is, and it delves into those deeper topics of belonging and tribalism, as you mentioned. We'll go into those a little bit later, but for the time being, this is your first venture into the world of playwriting, and at the Edinburgh Fringe as a performer. So could you just give us a bit of insight into, like, the early stages of the piece's development? You know, how has the piece evolved from you standing there at Wembley Way with all of the hot bodies, and how have you, and how has it evolved from that until, like, whereabouts with it now, where, you know, we're getting geared up ready for festival season?
Sure. So yeah, well, I was in my second year at drama school when that whole tournament was being played, and so I went home from Wembley Way, and then a few days later sort of really became invested in this guy that stuck a flower up his ass, and then started kind of just mind mapping things on a wall in the flat that I lived in whilst I was at drama school, and just started writing, like, weird post-it notes that if people sort of came into my room, they'd have thought I was absolutely insane. And why have you got pictures of this guy sticking a flower up your ass on the wall? So it kind of was there, but with kind of the pressures and the kind of concentration levels you need to get through your drama school, I kind of parked it to one side, but it was always kind of fizzing away. And then when I graduated last year, I really kind of sat down with it and went back to why it was that I really was invested in this. Last summer, I went down to Chichester Festival and I watched Senior Festival Theatre and watched Sing Your Heart Out for the Lads by Roy Williams. A play that's, like, been on my radar for ages, and it was it was, like, just such an amazing experience. You know, it turned the whole theatre into a pub, and it was kind of like the play that I'd always wanted to kind of to see and almost as an audience member be a part of. And I then went and watched loads of interviews with him, and he said something that kind of really resonated with me. He was like, I don't condone hooliganism, I don't condone football hooligans, but I find them absolutely fascinating. He's like, they're the most fascinating people to me, because what has happened to you? The question is, what has happened to you to kind of behave in this way? Like, where is your place to make you feel like that? And that, I think, is such an interesting kind of concept when we you know, if we don't take these people at face value and we go, actually, like, God, why? You know, why are you behaving like that? You know, there's always a reason for everything. So then I dug deeper into that, and then I realised this is probably going to be a play about a young football fan who wants to feel like they belong. I guess there's kind of parallels to This Is England and those kind of sort of movies. Without it feeling like, I don't want it to feel like this kind of, as much as I love the film, like Green Street or Football Factory, I don't really want it to feel too much like that, because I think they're of a kind of different generation. I think we're now of this new social media age where someone like Billy in the play, his act of sticking a flare up his ass is instantly seen by the world. It doesn't feel as underground anymore as kind of these old football firms used to. They're, you know, if you get into a fight at football now, you can almost guarantee there's someone around with a camera. And there's obviously like pros to that in terms of policing, and but there's also kind of cons, I guess, in terms of just, you know, these things are so kind of like nuanced, but also they're kind of hectic in the same time. Like, I know kind of what you said about there being an energy at the core of football, and I think it can really like change someone. So I really looked into what it is about someone's week to week life, and what it is about those weekends that kind of power them through. Because I think you're right. I don't think football is about 90 minutes. I think it's about going to the pub beforehand. I think it's about being part of a community, seeing your friends, chatting to people on the terraces, starting chants, obviously supporting your team, looking at the news articles at work in the week. And it's kind of this big support system for a lot of people. But what if they abuse that, and what if they take it too far? I think that's kind of what the play is trying to look at, and how also with these kind of like fueled, energetic kind of fans and these diehard fans, what can that do to fans that maybe just want to watch the game and maybe enjoy the game for what it is, and how can that kind of push people to one side and make them feel like they ironically aren't part of a community? So it's kind of playing with that kind of dichotomy. And that's kind of where the play is. It's about, yeah, belonging and how football allows us to belong, but also how football kind of doesn't allow us to belong.
There's so much like ritual and escapism that I think goes into the sport. And it's interesting how you mention about how there's it sort of becomes like the pinnacle of a person's week, you know?
Yeah.
You've got the 5 days of the working week, sure. And then after that, you want, football is a person's escape, you know?
Yeah.
Like, and I mean, you know, I can probably safely say this is the case for Billy, you know?
Yeah.
There's like, I don't want to speak about the play like incorrectly, but I think for Billy as a character, it goes to much more than sport. There's a desire, I think, to be, I guess, would you say a heightened version of himself?
Absolutely. There's a line that's almost a direct quotation from an interview, and it says, you know, I'd had 16 cans of lager, I'd had 3 grams of cocaine, and I felt like a king. It's the king, it's the feeling like a king and being at the top of that kind of food chain, if you like, for Billy. Him and his best friend Adam grew up going to AFC Wimbledon games week in, week out. And it's when they, Billy works for his dad in his hair salon. And he finds that quite a challenging job because he doesn't really fit in. He doesn't actually know how to cut hair. So he's doing a lot of the computer admin stuff out the back. and sweeping up hair, and it's kind of all a little bit, it's all a bit mundane for him. And so I feel like that football then doesn't just become about loving the sport, but it also becomes this his escape, his time to feel something in his life. Yeah, I think that's kind of very true of how I certainly felt at times when I go to football, and that it's kind of my time to, it's kind of my therapy in a way, you know, just to kind of go there and just feel like I belong in this community. And yeah, I know all the people sort of around me where we stand at Brentford and stuff. And yeah, it's kind of, in that side of it, it's an amazing thing. But Billy and Adam find themselves in a pub one night and they meet a character called Wine Gum. And Wine Gum is kind of this, he's like the epitome of like a football kind of hooligan. He's described in the play as being bald and built like a brick shit house. Am I allowed to swear on this? This is probably a question I should have asked. But
I mean, to be honest, I think the title gives it away a bit, love. You know, like, yes. we're all right.
Yeah, fair enough.
No, honestly, you're fine. Don't worry. But you really touched on something that equally allures and haunts everybody, which is identity. You know?
Yeah.
And like there's a constant like seeking for what it is that we want and how we personally belong to it. And you know again, like in England, identity with football is such a massive correlation, right? So yeah. What do you think it is then about like this game that fans identify with, and how would you say you've used that to influence the direction of the work?
To be honest, it comes down to as well the fact that in football we have a pyramid system, so your team can climb the pyramid. I'll just take my example of being a Brentford fan. In the play, Billy's an AFC Wimbledon fan because I had to choose a team that was slightly less good than Brentford otherwise. My cousin and uncle are massive AFC Wimbledon fans, but I just wanted it to be kind of a lower league, have this kind of grittier feeling. Brentford are kind of living it up in the Premier League now, which is something that I never thought I'd say. But my point being is I started going when I was 10 years old and I hated football. I was very much like a put a play on in your front living room kind of kid. And I still am, and I still kind of resonate with that a lot. But when I got to 10, my brother's friend, it was New Year's Day, my brother's friend said, oh, why don't you just come with, you know, your brother and me, and we'll go. And oh, so I'm really not sure, but I just kind of remember walking into this, it was Griffin Park, which is kind of this really old school football ground. And the grass just being so kind of green, and like the sprinklers being on and the players warming up. And I just, there was some really dodgy music being played through the tannoys. And immediately you kind of felt like I was at home. Billy talks about it in the play that football starts with people. And I think that's kind of feeds into this whole idea of identity, is that, you know, if things are starting with people, then we need to know what our place is within that. And I know that my place kind of within Brentford is certainly, I've been there kind of going to the games for 13 years now. I remember the first game I ever went to. I remember the score. I can tell you that Gary Alexander probably means nothing to anyone, but Gary Alexander scored a winning goal in the 87th minute. And we're playing Dagenham and Redbridge at home. It's kind of these little details that I kind of hang on to because of the way they made me feel. And the most interesting thing about it is it's live theatre. And I think I identify the drama of it and the storytelling of it. I think that's what it is. I think it's football creates these amazing stories, and people, human beings, love stories. And particularly in this country, going back to the pyramid thing, if Brentford can go from playing at Griffin Park, but within 10 years, you know, having players like Erling Haaland, Cristiano Ronaldo coming to the ground, well then, you know, I turned to my brother at the time and said, will we ever see Ronaldo here? Because I didn't understand the game at that point. He said, no, of course we won't. But 10 years later, we do. And I think these amazing kind of stories that live within us and are what we gravitate to, these amazing things like Leicester winning the league against all the odds a few years back. There's also Dear England by James Graham on at the National at the moment. And kind of one of the big running themes that he's really taken is that storytelling aspect. I mean, Gareth Southgate, there's literally a scene at the towards the beginning of the play where he breaks down the three-act structure for the new and improved Southgate England side. And I've just found that fascinating because it is, I think that kind of, I don't know if it answers the question directly, but I think the first thing is, I think it's chance, who we fall in love with, what team we fall in love with. I think that's a bit down to chance, a bit down to where we live. But then once we have those stories and those memories, just like having a relationship with a person, you feel the desire to protect that and tell people that they are your stories and they are the best stories. You know, no one will be able to argue with me and say that any team have better stories than Brentford, because those memories are so personal to me. And all the fans that I've kind of, you know, gone through those stories with. So I think, yeah, I think the pyramid system and the way that football's set up, it just allows for, and say the word again, stories and storytelling. And I think that's a universal thing. And then whether football kind of taps into your psyche, I think, you'll run with it and you'll love it.
Listen, we have Alex Hill here from Why I Stuck a Flare Up My Arse for England. We are going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. And we're back. So, you touched a bit upon this in the first half. Flair, it's not only an exploration of football, it's a deeper look into the themes of, you know, tribalism and belonging, masculinity, and, you know, we take the sport as a context, right? But these are all very key parts of just general identity. Why did you want to include them into this play?
I think it was just kind of like the natural avenue when doing this. It kind of goes back to that kind of, when we go to football, we feel a part of something. And having your team is almost like having your tribe. You have the colours of your team, you have like the badge. It's a complete representation of kind of, you know, of who you are. And you can also kind of, well, I think so anyway, you can kind of tell a lot about a person by their football team. I have a mate who's a Man United fan, but he isn't really. Do you know what I mean? He's not been to a game in years. So that's always kind of this, it's very petty, but it's kind of this like thing of, well, you don't really belong there, do you? Because you're not from Manchester, and you're from Surrey, and you've been to more Brentford games this year than you have Man United. So pull your finger out, mate. And it becomes like, that's like a microscopic level of like the tribalism. And then of course you've got that kind of darker side of it, and what happens away from just kind of casual banter and in the workplace or in the you know, on like on the terraces or whatever. And then you've kind of got, you know, the darker side and these kind of gatekeepers of football, or these kind of so-called gatekeepers that think they kind of, you know, run their community, a bit like Winegum, the character in the play, who kind of, you know, he thinks he's an ambassador for the team, and if you don't kind of fit into these certain kind of categories, then you're not really welcome, or at least not made to feel welcome on like a microaggressive kind of way. Which is obviously it's terrible, and we've kind of seen a lot of that in the news and the media about kind of the racism and the homophobia within the game, and how that's kind of perpetuated throughout people's kind of behaviour and what they kind of feel an acceptable thing to like chant on the terraces, and there's so many kind of, I think it's a very nuanced thing as well, because I listen, it's really, 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 really sad, but I listen to TalkSport every single morning, and Simon Jordan's always on there, and Jim White's always on there, and the debate always crops up as like, you know, I think Simon Jordan's always kind of very, very outspoken about the fact that he doesn't think kind of politics and these kind of like issues should exist within the game. Whereas Jim White's very much like, of course they should, of course we should use football, the national sport, as kind of a platform to be able to discuss these issues. And I think that's a really complicated and nuanced debate as well, because I don't think it's as black and white as that. I think it's because I think you know, fans arrive in their thousands to match days, and you don't always know what ones are saying these things out loud. It comes down to, you know, if a club bans a supporter, are they banning the right one, or are they not banning all of them for these kind of chanting, these chants that they might do, or this like behaviour that they might engage in. So I think it's a really complex thing, and I think it all kind of feeds back into that aspect of belonging and feeling part of a tribe, and yeah, this is us, so it can't be you, because you have a different scarf on, and in the darker sense, or you have like a different skin colour to me, and that, therefore you can't fucking be part of it, which is just kind of abhorrent, really. Abhorrent to kind of think that it still exists in the game. But yeah, I mean, that's kind of where the character of kind of Winegum stems from. But there's also this kind of weird, strange thing in this country that Spoken touched upon in the play, of as soon as it hits England, and England are playing in a World Cup or in a Euros, like, let bygones be bygones, and we're all one, and we're all together. And then that's got its own kind of fickleness as well. Because when, as we see, it doesn't go our way in a penalty shootout, people always look to see who they can blame. At times I think that's a very toxic thing. I think there's great camaraderie and great kind of banter to be had about the kind of the microscopic element of that, and you know, it's kind of part of our day-to-day lives of, oh, you know, it's just another Man City fan, or you know, he wins everything, and it's you know, that's great, and that's kind of helps the game flourish and be full of fun and colour and light. But then, you know, when I think people kind of miss the nuance of that beautiful kind of camaraderie, and they, you know, they bring their own kind of personal issues to it, is when we get these kind of horrible situations that we often find ourselves kind of like reading about in the news or talking about.
Oh yeah, and you do see like a lot of this stuff on social media advertised. The one that always comes around on the circles whenever there's a massive game is always the one for domestic abuse. I think there's a stat. I'd have to Google it. So like, I wouldn't take my word as gospel, but I know it's of like domestic abuse is generally increased when there's a match day, and it's I think it's like doubled if a supportive team loses. It's like that investment into the sport goes beyond just being like, you know, like a loss for the game. It's a personal loss to like the fans, you know, and how we deal with that. Like, obviously, as mentioned, it shouldn't happen, you know, it really shouldn't, like,
no,
but the fact is that it does, and it's important that this play is open to tackle these issues, you know.
Yeah, I think a lot of people kind of use football as an excuse or a crutch, if you like, to kind of like bring their own bullshit into, you know, into using football as their like means of saying, oh, well, it's football, innit, so it's fine. You know, that's kind of a really messed up thing. We should just be able to go to the games and have a laugh and have some beers and have a good day and then go home. But it's not as easy for some people as that, and particularly for characters like Winegum in the play, who kind of have this generational trauma of the England football team as well, and how that differs from kind of Billy and Adam's experience of the England team. I can't really say, like, as a 22-year-old man, that I've like really gone through much of the like England football side kind of trauma. I've kind of been spoiled, really. A World Cup semi-final, a European final, Southgate's kind of renaissance period. But we're so hung up on it. We're so hung up on kind of winning and this kind of need to be better than the other person. And what that kind of energy does is used as a catalyst, and it has to be offloaded somewhere, because it's a dangerous kind of emotion. And some people, yeah, they have to offload it somewhere. And I'm not saying that's right by any means, but that is the danger of it, of believing in something so vigorously and passionately, that it spills over and creates a whole load of issues where we don't even feel that it's necessary.
Yeah, and I mean, there's multiple avenues we can go down with this one, and one of the ones we can talk about in relation to this work is men's mental health. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's a topic that's brought up so much in the media.
Yeah.
But even like today in the modern world, men really can find it like difficult just to talk about how they're going on. It could be such a taboo, right? So yeah. You know, you were saying how for some people, like, football is an outlet for that. Why do you think this is? And how would you say that Flair addresses this?
I think we kind of gravitate towards the, we mentioned the word in this podcast already, but escapism of it. And kind of how, especially for Billy, how he can go to the football and feel kind of something that he doesn't get to feel during his week. He feels like he's part of something. And that's a great thing. That is an amazing kind of thing that, you know, Billy goes through. He finds a place in the world. The problem is it's not the place for him, and it's not the place really for anybody. But it's that question of, is it better to have a place and not have a place at all? And I think that's kind of where the men's mental health feeds in, particularly for young men, and all the stereotypes we've kind of built up about what it is to be a man, and how, you know, you go about that. I think it's really important that it's part of this show. I don't want to give too much about the plot away, but Billy and Adam, their friendship starts. We kind of see a snippet of them when they were 10 years old, and we kind of see how their kind of brotherhood, if you like, is so strong, and how kind of open and playful they are with each other as kids. But as they kind of get involved with this gang, what happens to their relationship becomes a little bit more artificial, and not as kind of honest and open, and how that can then start to make people feel like outcasts, even though they're part of this squad or this gang or team, if you like. We also kind of meet Billy and Adam on their match days in a cafe that they spend every Saturday morning, and it's 9 a.m. they meet in the cafe and they have a full English, and it's their chance to just chat about everything and anything that they've gone through in their week. And as the play develops, that kind of special time kind of gets taken away from them. And I think it's this idea that sometimes we kind of get carried away with what's right in front of us without kind of stopping and going, actually, like, I'm not okay. I don't feel like doing this today. I don't feel like doing this thing. And it's really interesting. I was having a conversation with someone the other day, and we kind of spoke about this idea of, with young men in particular, there's always this like thing when it comes to mental health of people going, oh yeah, like, you can do it, mate. You know, you get up, you can do it. And kind of encouraging them on to do things, when actually a lot of the time they want the permission just to go, no, I don't want to do this. And I think that's kind of like a really interesting thing that's been born out of, weirdly, a guy sticking a flare up his arse and the starting image of that, and all these kind of like little ingredients that have been thrown into the play. But I think it's kind of front and centre of the play thematically, and how football acts as an amazing outlet, but also can also act as an incredibly vicious mask for how we're really feeling. I think the act of football chanting and chanting a song in unison with people really brings out this kind of like visceral energy that kind of exists within us. And sometimes I feel after a football game that I've subconsciously got a load of stuff out of my system from my working week just by kind of joining in with those chants. So stuff like that is great, but you know, it's always important to kind of put the brakes on and just check in with your mates, I guess.
If we consider the journey of this show, you know, so we talked about the early development earlier, but like if you're listening and you're planning to come along to see the show, what do you want audiences to take away from this once they leave the venue?
I mean, that's like, that is a $1 million question, isn't it? I keep getting asked this, and it's like, I, do you know what, Toby? I think that the best kind of most enriching theatre experiences I have are the ones where I walk out, and then I go and speak to people about the play or the musical, whatever it is we've seen, and we all have kind of different takeaway points from it, you know. I think I'd love obviously for audiences to kind of walk out and think, okay, that was, you know, a guy that made some wrong choices and made some mistakes, and be honest with themselves and be like, you know, I could have easily made those same choices and those same mistakes, and have I made those same choices, and what am I going to do to kind of rectify that, and how am I going to move forward and make sure that my life is a bit more honest, and I'm a bit kinder to myself about who I am and my own identity, and you know, maybe not fabricating that as much. I mean, we're all like kind of our worst enemies when it comes to that word identity, because everyone has this kind of, because you can't control it, unfortunately. I think there's this weird thing where we all think we can, but you know, what you think of yourself is a million miles away to what other people might think of yourself, of you, sorry. And if, you know, if you spend, you know, weeks and weeks with a person, you're going to have a different kind of experience to if you meet someone for 25 minutes for a coffee, and that's your kind of only interaction. So I think just being kinder to yourself and kinder to the people around you, and leaving the theatre feeling like you want to kind of check in with your mates, I think that's going to be hopefully particularly kind of truthful for young men that come and watch the play. I also must say that watching Dear England at the National Theatre and this kind of work being made is so amazing, because there's and Sing Your Heart Out for the Lads and these kind of football based plays, because I think there's often this kind of stereotype of theatre goers that football fans kind of hold, of like, oh, I don't belong in a theatre, that's not for me, that's too artsy or too it's just not my bag, you know, you would never catch me in the theatre. And there is a scene in the play where Billy meets this girl and he misses a game to go see Les Mis, and it's purposefully in there kind of to show these kind of parallels that exist within us and exist between the football community and the theatre community, and how actually we all actively just long for drama, and we long for conflict, and we long for feeling visceral emotions, and when we do, sometimes we don't know how to control them, and I think that's kind of I'd love for football fans to kind of come and see the play. I've had a couple of Brentford people already sort of buy tickets for their London previews, and that's just such an amazing feeling to be able to say that, like, my mates who have always identified as football fans are going to be kind of sat in the theatre, and if that could be like a gateway to maybe more theatrical experiences for them, that I would be very I'd be very happy with that. That'd be kind of a job well done.
Like you say, there's so much parallel between sport and theatre. Like if we, you know, if we really, 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 really boil it down to its core, both are forms of entertainment. You know, both are a selection of people choosing to spend their time engaging with a form of entertainment through somebody else. That's it at its very simplest form, right? So how, like, sport, in this case football, or theatre to do that, you know, that they differ, and for good reason, but it's important to acknowledge that you're not one camp or the other.
It's all fickle. Yeah, it's all fickle. And I think people, again, it comes back to tribalism and the identity thing of, like, oh, well, this is me, so this will always be me, and this will never, like, I'll never ever be seen to do something else because people know me for this and that's my safety net. But, like, what if you just went and watched a game of croquet? Do you know what I mean?
Do you know what I mean? Like, or, like, what if you just went and, like, did some pottery or something?
Yeah.
I don't know. It feels kind of like we should, like, without getting too philosophical, you've got kind of one life and spread your palate.
Both sport and theatre, they're things that talk to people, like, internal emotions, but in two different languages. That's the best way I think I could probably put it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Listen, Alex, it's been a pleasure getting to speak to you about the show on here. So, before we leave you be, the question of the day. What's the next stage for you, and why I stuck a flare up my arse for England? What can we expect from you during and post the Edinburgh Fringe?
A Netflix special, 6 parts, and...
Okay,
oh,
bloody hell.
I'm obviously...
I'll be asking you for a spare tenner in the middle.
I think it's a difficult one because the main focus is obviously getting through the Old Red Lion previews, then spending a month up in Edinburgh doing the play night after night, and just kind of seeing the reception that it gets, and that's always kind of a nervy feeling. But I believe in the story, and I believe in the importance of the story that's being told on stage, and I know that it's a story that I want to be I'd want to see on stage. So, you know, it would be great to maybe get a longer London run for it afterwards, and kind of get more bums on seats. And I think the Old Red Lion, I'm so thankful that they've kind of taken it on and taken a chance with it, because it's such a kind of football orientated pub in North London, and, like, you know, such a football orientated place, and it would be so great for, as I touched upon earlier, football fans to get in there. That's not to say that I also think it would be a great kind of story to tell through TV, and I think, you know, there's kind of an appetite for it at the moment with Ted Lasso and things like that. Kind of, we're seeing more and more football on screen, and I think we're slowly working out how to tell football orientated kind of stories on screen. So, I mean, I'd love that. I'd love that to happen. I have no idea where you even start with a process like that. But yeah, that would be kind of the dream for why I stuck a flare up my arse for England. But just really happy to be kind of telling the story at the Fringe and for a couple of nights in London as well.
And where can we find you online, Alex?
Oh, God. hopefully in all the right places.
We had a chat in the break.
We had a good chat in the break, didn't we, about, like, the title of the play and people thinking this could be a biopic of the guy that actually stuck a flare up his ass. I'm not that guy.
No.
And we are, the play is, I think it's at Bum Flare Play on Twitter, and it's at Bum Flare Play on Instagram as well. So let me just at Bum Flare Play on Instagram as well. And then obviously we've got the kind of production company that we're running everything through, Roxy Dog Productions, which is www.roxydog.co.uk, where you will find a whole load of info about the show, and then some links to the London previews at the Old Red Lion, but also obviously the big one, the Edinburgh Fringe, at the Space UK. So that's that. Yeah.
Wonderful stuff. And cool. What are the London previews?
Oh, the London previews are on Saturday the 29th of July and Sunday the 30th of July, and they're both at 7:30. And I think you can get your tickets on the Old Red Lion Theatre website.
Yep, and that's down in London.
That's down in London.
In the London previews, as he previously mentioned.
in the London yes. previews taking place
in London.
Kent. Yeah.
yeah. As ever, if you take a listen to the bloody hell, we'll start that one again. Take a look in the episode description. You'll find all the relevant information you need that Alex has mentioned, and follow the links, support the artist, etc., etc. Alex, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me, Toby. It's been absolute joy, albeit a bit hot.
just a little
hot, isn't it? Yeah,
it's been absolutely ravenous with heat.
Ravenous with heat.
And that was Alex. As you've heard, this is going to be quite possibly one of, in my opinion at least, one of those sleeper hits of the Fringe this year. Please go up and support Alex and Why I Stuck a Flare Up My Arse for England. I'll just give you a bit of information about the show. Flare plays from the 4th to the 12th and the 14th to the 22nd of August at The Space at Nidri Street. Shows will begin at 20 past 10 in the evening, and they last for 50 minutes. All of the relevant information Alex mentioned in terms of where you can find him and tickets for the show, I will include for you in the episode description. This is the Edinburgh Fringe special of The Next Stage. We are going through our picks of the shows at The Fringe that you do not want to miss. Stay tuned to our newest episodes. We have more coming your way. And for the meantime, we'll see you at The Next Stage.